It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. State lawmakers have left the Capitol until after the November 6th election. They passed several bills before the recess, but at least one major piece of legislation is still sitting in the Senate. WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief Katie Meyer joins us from Harrisburg. Hello, Katie.
Hello.
Katie, the Senate did not approve a House-passed bill concerning child sex abuse victims. What would that measure have done?
So it does a number of things. There are provisions that the House and Senate did agree on. The bill would have gotten rid of the statute of limitations on sexual abuse going forward. So there wouldn't be any limitations on when somebody could sue for, if they were abused as children. It would have, raised the amount that they could recoup from those lawsuits. But the big thing, and the thing that ultimately sort of sank these negotiations, was a retroactivity provision, basically. The House's version would have opened a 2-year window for retroactive lawsuits. And what that means is, if your statute of limitations has run out already, you can go back in, if this had passed, and sue in these 2 years. So that's a provision that the House supported, House Democrats and Republicans. The governor supports it. The attorney general supports it. Victim advocates support it. Senate Democrats supported it. But Senate Republicans did not. They basically said that they were concerned that it was unconstitutional for a while, and then they were also concerned that it would, bankrupt churches, and that could harm the people who were, benefiting from those institutions. So a whole lot of things. But what ended up happening was the Senate floated a provision that would have opened a retroactivity window, but it wouldn't have applied it to institutions. So you could sue an individual priest retroactively, but you couldn't sue a church. And that caused some uproar. A lot of people were saying that they were siding with the churches, basically. And it should be said that the Catholic Church and insurance lobbyists opposed the window. So they are in line with them. After that, negotiations pretty much broke down. The Senate did not pass anything because the House wasn't going to accept it. And they all went home. And, that was the last day of the session. So it's very unclear if this is going to pass before everything ends.
So the idea of not being able to sue an organization but to sue an individual, let's face it, some of the alleged abusers are no longer alive. And number two, they certainly wouldn't have the resources that the Catholic Church would have.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, a lot of the people named in the grand jury report that kind of started this whole thing, yeah, they're dead. And many others, clergy are not notoriously wealthy. So that is a really important thing to bring up in this. Churches do have a lot of money and would be, I would say, more could come of a lawsuit against a church for sure.
The House and Senate have very limited schedules after the election, and the session ends November 30th, I believe, correct?
Yes, they're both in one day. And those are sessions that in recent years specifically, they have not historically passed anything.
They could add days to the calendar or not?
They could. Again, a lot of this just goes by precedent, and you don't see them adding many days after the election. But, if there's political will and they find that they can come to some sort of a compromise, maybe they'll come back. From what I was seeing, it doesn't look like a compromise is in the offing.
Another major proposal that did not come to pass was a measure to shrink the state legislature, the state house in particular, from 203 to 151 members. Because it's a constitutional amendment, it has to get passed in two consecutive legislative sessions. So why did it fail after getting passed the first time?
Well, I think it's this phenomenon, because you're right, it passed the last legislative sessions, I believe, 2 years ago. The phenomenon is that the first vote is sort of a test vote. It sort of doesn't feel real because it's not really real. It's just the first volley. But then in this vote, this was the do or die. This was, do we want to send this to voters and let them decide if they want to shrink us? And the answer to that was no. People did change their votes. You saw a lot of pressure from people who were concerned that they could lose their seats if the House shrank. And so it didn't happen. It didn't even get a final, full vote on the House floor. It died kind of sadly.
Was this a, hey, if we, the House, have to cut back, so does the Senate?
There was some of that, yeah. House members amended the bill to include the Senate, which would have meant that it couldn't pass this session because it had new language. They sent that over to the Senate. The Senate took out that provision. They reverted it to the previous language, sent it back to the House. So it's one of those things. The Senate is not going to shrink its own numbers.
Is there any evidence that shrinking the legislature would save any significant amount of money? Or is it just sort of looking good in terms of politics to, yes, we want to cut back?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I looked into this several months ago when it looked like this bill might actually pass. And there have been lots of studies on like what makes for an efficient legislature. It would save a little bit of money, but not, you know, like a significant amount. I mean, the state budget's billions of dollars, and it would only be like maybe a couple million. So that's sort of not a huge factor here, I would say. What, you know, a lot of people talk about, like, well, efficiency, like how many bills does a legislature pass? Like, how do you really measure how good a system is working? And I guess the answer is it's difficult to do that. And all legislatures are a little bit dysfunctional in their own way. Pennsylvania is an outlier. I mean, we have the largest full-time legislature in the country. So, you know, we do have a lot of people on payroll here.
So we talked about what didn't pass. What do you think were the important bills that did get passed down this stretch here?
Yeah, there was a huge slew of them. One of the big ones that I had been watching for a while because it was sort of tied up in the House was this bill on human trafficking. Basically, it forbids law enforcement from treating child victims of human trafficking who are being prostituted, essentially. It bans them from treating those children as criminals. So you have to, you know, treat this person as a child who has been taken advantage of. They can't be prosecuted. So that's significant. That's a bill that, you know, passed unanimously in the House and in the Senate, but spent a lot of time just kind of languishing on the House floor. A lot of people thought it was being used as collateral to get other bills passed. It happened a couple of different times, but that finally did pass. There was an anti-hazing bill that would, among other things, increase penalties for certain kinds of hazing. That sort of similar situation was stalled for a while in the House, but then did move late in the session. So those are a couple of big ones.
The hazing, was that like in college campuses or elsewhere?
Yes, that's about college campuses. And that was spurred by the death of Timothy Piazza. He was an undergraduate at Penn State who died in a hazing-related incident.
Katie Meyer is WESA's Capital Bureau Chief. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Democrats have a real chance of taking control of the U.S. House in the midterm elections in 2 weeks. But 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins reports there are still plenty of seats where Republicans are favored, including Pennsylvania's 14th congressional district.
And now, everyone, please eat and enjoy yourselves.
How are you? Nice to see you. I'm Bibby.
This is the bustling annual picnic for the Murraysville Democrats. But Bibby Anaborio barely has time for food. Bibby, and she wants you to call her Bibby, is talking to everybody. She needs to get her name out in the 14th district, which includes Washington, Fayette, Greene, and much of Westmoreland County. Borio is among an unprecedented number of women on the ballot nationwide this year, but she's never run for office before.
I concluded that I would forever regret it if I didn't give it a run because I knew how important it was going to be in this election that we fought every race.
Borio grew up in Latrobe. Her dad was a member of the United Auto Workers Union, and she went on to become an executive at Ford Motor Company. After that, she became managing director at the British car maker Jaguar.
But I like to tell people that even though I kind of made it to that top executive level, I don't look like your typical corporate executive, and I never forgot where I came from.
She moved back to Latrobe a few years ago to take care of her mom, who had a heart attack. Her mom previously had breast cancer, and so did two of Borio's sisters. That family history made healthcare her number one issue. She criticizes Republican attempts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act.
It's like, how many pillars of healthcare can you pull out before it comes tumbling down?
She also supports the expansion of Medicaid under the ACA.
I also think that the healthcare expansion has been so important in helping to start to tackle opioid addiction, that I worry about someone who wants to go for the perfect as opposed to let's make the good better.
Her opponent this November is Republican Guy Reschenthaler, and he takes a different view. He says he would vote to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act if he won the race.
We have the premier health care system in the world here in the United States, but we need to keep our advantage.
The two candidates have also had very different careers. This would be Reschenthaler's third elected office, and he's only 35. Borio is 64. Reschenthaler served in the Navy as a lawyer, where he says he prosecuted terrorists in Iraq. After his service, he ran for district judge in Pleasant Hills. And before he finished out his term as district judge, he ran for state senator in a 2015 special election.
And I've been committed to not only good public policy, but making sure that we're reaching across the aisle, getting things done, and working in a bipartisan manner.
Reschenthaler touts a bill he co-sponsored that would provide depression screenings for students in 6th and 11th grade.
I truly believe that's going to make a huge difference in the opioid crisis because too many young people who have depression start to self-medicate with marijuana and underage drinking, and that leads to opioid addiction and heroin abuse.
The Senate passed that legislation unanimously, and it's now sitting in a House committee. Reschenthaler has been criticized for writing the foreword to a book by Carl Higbee, a conservative commentator. He and Reschenthaler used to host a radio show together, and the book contains passages that have been criticized as racist and homophobic. But Reschenthaler says he wrote the foreword without having read the book. Still, most politicos say Borio has her work cut out for her in the district, which Donald Trump won by a 2-1 margin 2 years ago. David Mizra is a professor at the Community College of Allegheny County, and he worked for one of Borio's Democratic rivals before the primary.
It's just a tough nut to crack for any Democrat. The way this district has been redrawn, it's gone from a red to a redder one.
Reschenthaler has an A rating from the National Rifle Association and a B rating from Americans for Prosperity, a conservative economic group. Borio has widespread backing from labor unions, including the auto workers. Overall, the race has been quiet. There hasn't even been a debate between the candidates. But voters will have their say on November 6th. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, a number of factors can influence how a school district decides which elementary schools feed into middle and high schools. And in Pittsburgh, there were additional challenges. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden explores what shaped the city's evolving feeder pattern. And what would it take to upend the school-to-prison pipeline, where kids get in trouble at school, setting themselves down a path toward incarceration? Those questions and more are the focus of an upcoming production at City Theater on the South Side. More stories and conversations coming up next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the first jazz seminar opens at the University of Pittsburgh in 1971. The event was the first academic seminar of its kind in the country when it was established by saxophonist Dr. Nathan Davis. Now, in its 47th year, the annual festival draws an international crowd and world-renowned performers. It also features free lectures and demonstrations at the school's Oakland campus and Pittsburgh neighborhood community centers. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for October 22nd, 2018.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today we hear from a Sheridan resident trying to redefine her community through her organization's neighborhood support initiatives. Terry Minor Spencer leads West End Power, which stands for Providing Opportunities with Effective Resources. Minor Spencer spoke with 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort about how the program started 3 years ago.
We started an adult GED program because our men and women, you know, were lacking employment because of not graduating from high school. So me and two other members went and got certified through the Pittsburgh Literacy Council. Now we teach the GED program. We partner with the West Side Salvation Army over here. We do kettlebells. We help with a lot of their programs that they have. If something is in need of, we do a lot of gather up the resources for the community, just trying to make sure that the community is at the table.
What motivated you to do these things?
You know what, just having a conversations with our community members, you know, them not knowing what was going on, lack of support throughout the whole community, because a lot of people call the West End, some like to say we are the forgotten community. That's what really started the lack of new knowledge or the lack of what's really going on. And we just decided to, you know, let's get together and try to find out what's going on and bring it to the community so everyone knows.
Why was it said that the West End is forgotten? Why were people saying that?
Well, people like to say that. They still kind of say that because it seems as though we were speaking different languages. This table will be saying one thing, and the rest of Pittsburgh is speaking one language, and then West End would seem to be the last at the table. So it kind of got like that, and then it kind of got like we became stagnated. You know, we became stagnated, and so now we're moving forward, you know, and try to build unity as one and speak one language so we can all be on the same page and at the same table.
What more would you like to do? Do you see things where they should be, or is there more you'd like to do?
I love to see thriving people making it. I'm a strong believer that if you know something, share it with someone else. Don't hold it. Because that's where we stay stagnated. You know, if you got something to share and if it can help the next person, share it. That's the only way that we can grow. And one of my friends had said how can we get our seniors to sit back out on the porch? You know, how can we get our seniors to not be afraid to tell a young man, pull your pants up? You know, or tell a young lady, hey, that's not how you're supposed to be talking. How can we get our seniors back in our community feeling safe and a part of our community? So, right, that's something we're working on as well. Everyone's included, everyone has a seat, everyone is welcome, and everyone feels like this is part of what they can go to and say, hey, how can we help?
Terry Minor Spencer of Power, providing opportunities with effective resources, thank you for taking time to do this interview.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The map that determines which public school a kid is assigned to in the city of Pittsburgh is full of strange shapes and jagged lines. The last time the district changed these boundaries was in 2012, when there were too many buildings, not enough students, and budget issues. As part of our series, Dividing Lines, 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden examines how these challenges shape the feeder pattern the city school district uses today.
Kate Anglin and her husband recently purchased a home less than a mile from the Greenfield K-8 school. A key selling point was that it zones to that particular school. Anglin says figuring out these boundaries wasn't easy.
That was a frustrating process since there was no map to do that.
For each home they considered, the Anglins typed its address into a portal on the district's website, which tells you what school a certain address is assigned to. To figure out exactly what was going on with school assignments, WESA created a map of the district's feeder pattern, which I showed to Anglin.
There's a lot of little fingers and little blocks that look like they're cut out into different schools, and it'd be very interesting to look at individual blocks to see the logic or the politics of why those are that way.
School assignments used to be even more of a patchwork. Kate Reed was director of strategic priorities for the school district, where she played a key role in the 2012 realignment. Reed and I meet up at the corner of Station Street and Center Avenue near the Home Depot in East Liberty.
This was definitely a community that had a lot of different elementary feeder schools that sort of convalesced in one area and had varying borders, some more logical than others.
Boundaries of the elementary schools of Lincoln, Fulton, and the now-closed Fort Pitt converged at the intersection where Reed and I stand. Before realignment, the western side of Center Avenue flip-flopped back and forth between Fort Pitt and Fulton for about half a mile. Another problem was the old elementary feeder pattern didn't neatly overlap with the middle schools, which didn't overlap with the high schools. So when students aged into a new building, they were with a different mix of kids. Reed says this was stressful.
It wasn't fair. And that's an opinion, not a fact. But like in my opinion, it just wasn't fair to families.
Today, school assignments are more uniform. Each elementary school funnels students to only one middle or high school, depending on whether the elementary is a K-5 or K-8. Getting to this point was complicated and painful, including the closing of Oliver and Langley high schools. Yet today's map still looks bananas. Feeder borders zigzag across the city like lightning. Some zoning is still non-contiguous. And that might always be the case, due to both Pittsburgh's labyrinth-like street grid and ever-changing demographics.
If we look right here at the corner, there used to be a huge high-rise. Now there's a Target. Guess how many kids are living in the Target? Zero.
And when you consider redlining, desegregation, and population decline, tracing the history of this map is like untangling an endless knot. James Fogarty is the executive director of A-Plus Schools, a Pittsburgh nonprofit that advocates for education quality and equity. He says the old feeder was not only confusing, it created an unequal distribution of resources.
At the time, you had 10 schools that didn't have arts, didn't have music, didn't have a librarian.
Funding is partly enrollment-based, so schools in neighborhoods that had lost population had smaller classes and therefore less money. After realignment, students and staff were more equally distributed. For example, Pittsburgh-Manchester got a librarian one day a week, but Colfax's music teacher was cut to part-time.
To get some kids, predominantly black children in this district, predominantly in high-poverty schools, the resources that white children predominantly were getting in their schools meant that we had to do some shifts.
Despite these changes, performance outcomes today are still lower for black students than white. And demographics continue to shift, so the district is likely to revisit its feeder pattern before today's grade schoolers go to college. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
Find more from our series, Dividing Lines, at wesa.fm/dividinglines. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The school-to-prison pipeline is an oft-repeated phrase, one with very serious implications. Pittsburgh City Theater is calling attention to the disproportionate disciplining of minority students, which can put them on the pathway to eventual incarceration through its latest work, Pipeline. The show runs October 27th to November 18th, and the facility's artistic producer, Reginald Douglas, is here. Welcome, Reg.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning. Also in studio is Angel Gober. She is the lead education justice organizer for the Education Rights Network and leads their Solutions, Not Suspensions, and Counselors, Not Cops campaigns. Welcome, Angel. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Angel, I'm going to start with you. I briefly described the pipeline. It starts with which students are punished and how they are punished, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So if you explain a little bit more about that pipeline and how the punishment can lead eventually, possibly, to incarceration.
So the school-to-prison pipeline, it's not a phrase that you have to really think really hard about. So the way that I'm very clear on what the definition is. And so when we think about our education system and we think about our students in our education system and making sure that they're actually in their classrooms learning. And when that is threatened with, over policing or, zero tolerance policies or severe punishments for, minor like childlike behavior, it then puts students on a path very quickly into entering the juvenile justice system. So that's how I think about the school-to-prison pipeline, and that's some of the work that we think about every single day.
As you've been working on it, has the disparity eased at all over the last few years or whenever?
Well, you know, we take a real deep dive in looking at suspension data,
right,
and school push out, and it's broken down by, you know, race, gender, disability. And so we do see that, like, suspensions are going down, but, you know, we also need to think about what type of services and supports are in place in our school system so that we make sure that kids get the right resources that they need to thrive.
While they are maybe serving a suspension or to avert suspensions in the first place?
So if I could have it my way, I would ban suspensions pre-K to college, right? So, like, we need to really think about how do we invest in students and communities to make sure that they have what they need instead of pushing them out from their education?
One more fact, and this was from a report that was released in August from the University of Pittsburgh Center on Race and Social Problems. It showed that in Allegheny County, African-American students are suspended at 7 times the rate as non-black peers. You're not surprised by that?
Absolutely not. I mean, we think about racial bias. You know, we think about schools being underfunded and not supported. You know, we think about, you know, oversized classrooms. So there's just many, many factors that contribute to school pushout and suspensions.
All right. So The Work Pipeline was authored by Obie Award-winning playwright Dominique Morisseau. Reginald, live theater often tackles social issues, race, politics. But what about this issue? Injustice in the education system. What did it say to you to sort of say, I want to present this play?
Sure. I mean, City Theater is dedicated to putting our world on stage, you know, the truth of our country and our culture, both the good and the bad. And so our job is to show humanity in all its forms, the harsh sides of our country, as well as some of the hope. And I think through theater, we see a family deal with these issues. So we get a personal lens on the disproportionate amount of injustice in the education system that affects African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
As a theater director, the piece is wonderfully imaginative and full of music and rhythm and language. Dominique, the MacArthur Genius Grant winner now, is also a poet. And so it's a wonderful theatrical, funny, uplifting piece, but at the same time, it has the gut punch of reality. And I think what City Theater does better than anyone else in town, if you ask me, is present the truth. And I think truth is both hard to hear sometimes, but also full of hope.
Wow.
And so that makes it a great piece of theater for me.
So, okay, so that's the piece of theater.
Yeah.
And you were talking about presenting the world on stage.
Yes.
So why is this issue, this play, important to you artistically and even personally?
Sure. Well, as an African-American director, I see myself in these characters. I see myself in this issue. You know, this is not a foreign concept to me. This is very personal. The character Omari, the protagonist of the play, is a student at a boarding school whose mom teaches at a lower income public school.
Mm-hmm.
And when he's pushed out of his boarding school, threatened with his third expulsion, which could lead to him being incarcerated for an act of violence that has nothing to do with his education. It's due to stereotype. It's due to systematic viewing of him as a monster, he says.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way people in this world might look at me. And so my job as an artist is to present my truth and then share that with someone else to garner empathy, deeper understanding, and create a dialogue. And so, you know, for me as an African-American artist and City Theater as a company, our job is to present, again, truth on stage. And truth can be hard to hear, but it can also be full of hope. And that's the way I try to lead my life and lead the art that I make.
All right. And this boarding school is mostly white.
Yes. The boarding school is predominantly white. He's one of the few black students in class. I know that experience personally. Going to Georgetown, I was one of few. And there's definitely the microaggressions that happen in a classroom as well as the macroaggressions. And I think what Dominique does in the play is present both through a family. And I think we can all agree there's no better way to understand the politics of our country than through the personal. And I think by looking at this family who you come to really care about, you get a deeper glimpse into what's at stake for African-American families in this country.
Angel, I wanted to ask you, so here Omari, the young student, is at a mostly white boarding school. Reginald just told us about his experience at Georgetown, but the school-to-prison pipeline, the pipeline issue, how does the setting in the play, the story in the play, in a sense, compare to the reality maybe of what we think of the school-to-prison pipeline?
Well, I mean, when you think about, like, Pittsburgh Public Schools, so the majority of students in Pittsburgh Public Schools are Black. When we look at the data, you know, the majority of suspensions are Black students, Black males with disabilities and IEPs. And then, you know, the majority of school staff and administration are white. So when you don't necessarily have, you know, these people that are serving our students every day that look like them, that come from where they come from, that come from their neighborhoods, it definitely, you know, can increase some bias. And then we start thinking about push out and really understanding our students.
I mean, I think those are all themes. I mean, those are direct quotes from the play. You know, the racial bias. The mom is a teacher. So she's teaching her students Gwendolyn Brooks, We Real Cool. She's teaching them Invisible Man. She's teaching them Native Son. She's giving her students, as one of the few Black teachers at the public school, she's offering them ways to see themselves. And I think what Dominique is challenging an audience to understand is our education system should reflect back the community. Mm-hmm. And if it does, I believe, just from my own personal experience, that students can feel comfortable. They can feel eager to learn because they're not just learning words, they're learning themes that are present in their lives.
I mean, that's one of the campaigns that we're working on is definitely, you know, hiring and retaining more Black educators here in Pittsburgh Public Schools. And making sure that, you know, our white educators are trained and do have, you know, implicit bias training and racial sensitivity training. Because if you're going to work majority with Black students, it's very important to understand Black culture and able to connect with students to teach them.
To both of you, this play, Pipeline, Omari's mother, a teacher, her hopes for her son really aren't realized, are they? And how does one hold on to hope sort of against the odds? We'll start with you, Reginald.
Sure. Well, I'm going to challenge that thought. You got to come see the play. See how it ends. You know, I think what Naya's greatest hope for her son is that he can find true joy, true peace, comfort, and just being himself. You know, she says at the end, he needs more space to just be. And I think that we take that for granted sometimes, the privilege to just be yourself, particularly in a school. I think that is a great American quest and definitely an African-American quest, is how do you feel okay in the skin that you're in? And I think that's part of growing up for many young Black men, especially, that's what's being robbed of them. It's not just life literal with the over policing and the disproportionate amount of death in the Black community at the hands of particularly of cops, of white men, but also just the chance just to live, to find joy, to find happiness, to go to a bar and have a drink, to go to a restaurant, to fall in love, to just be yourself. That's her hope for her son. And I think, like many African-American mothers, and mine especially, you survive. You push through. You don't give up hope. You keep fighting. And I think that's what real justice is in this play. Real justice in this play is the power of a mother's love. And, you know, a word we use a lot in the theater is universal. I think there's nothing more universal than the specificity of a mother's love and how powerful it can be to overcome a hopeless world.
Angel.
So we call that freedom to thrive. So we think about our Black communities. We think about young Black males. You know, what does it really mean to thrive and not to survive? And I think we start with, you know, stop policing and over-policing our school system. We should not have school police in our schools. We should have resources and supports. You know, we don't need to make it easy for school police to be walking down the hallway disciplining students and possibly arresting them. Like, that is not a place for them. And so what does it really look like? You know, just envision it. What does it really, really look like? And so we really want to divest from over-policing our students and invest that more into education and supports.
Well, how do you balance that safety versus over-policing? Because you do want a safe environment, but how do you sort of enable that safe environment?
When I think about safety in our school system, I don't think about school police or security guards. I think about restorative practices. I think about, you know, having arts and music. I think about meditation or whatever supports students and families need should be right inside that school. I don't think about school police when I think about safety.
And Pittsburgh Public Schools have been implementing the restorative practices over the last few years.
Yes, slowly but surely, but definitely need more.
Okay. Reginald, you're not just putting on a typical production. You're also facilitating conversations after each performance.
Yes.
What's the purpose of that?
I guess, I mean, for city theater, art, our plays should spark conversation. And I wanted to provide a safe space for our audience to grapple with the big themes of this play. Family, race, education, history, legacy, identity. What does it mean to be an American? These are all themes and questions that the play raises. I wanted to make sure that we had space for our audience to breathe together, collectively tackle these themes, and have a conversation. And so we've partnered with about 20 wonderful African-American mothers that they can lead our conversations and encourage audiences to share their thoughts on the play, on its themes. So we have arts leaders, we have nonprofit leaders, we have poets, writers, all coming together after every performance to offer about 10 minutes of conversation. Theater should spark a dialogue. We want to have that dialogue at City Theater.
Angel, I'd like to get your take on that. So how can conversations involving audiences of all backgrounds, how can that help in the understanding of this issue and maybe either preventing it or remedying the problem?
I mean, it's about education. So it's about, you know, making people understand that, you know, school pushout is real. Divestment in communities is real. You know, people not being economically sound is real. So, like, we just need to continue to have these conversations. But, you know, at the Education Rights Network, we have these conversations with our parents every single day and making them understand that, you know, what's happening with you and your student actually happening to a lot of parents across the system. And so, you know, those are just ways that we, you know, educate is definitely by empowering our parents to think about the issue and how we actually change policy.
You both have mentioned parents, empowering parents. What is the role, you know, obviously being supportive and loving of their children, the students, but do they play also another role in the overall sense of security and even behavior within the schools?
Yeah, I'll say for the play, the mom, Naya, she's on the front lines. You know, I think every mom is fighting for their child to have the best. They want the best for their student. And I think that means you're active in every way. You're active in the school, you're active in the community, and you're mostly active, most active in your child's direct life and future. And so that's very important for the play, and I'm sure on the work you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of times parents are in a situation where they actually don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Especially when, you know, if their kid is being faced with like expulsion or like long term suspensions. And, you know, so like we actually provide supports and resources to parents and like, you know, making sure it is the law to educate students. Right. Even if they're suspended. So a lot of times we have to work closely with parents to help them figure out that system.
All right. We have just about 45 seconds left.
OK. And
so conversations, awareness about the school to prison pipeline. There are steps. But briefly, what else can be done aside from awareness and discussion?
So you can follow us on Facebook, Education Rights Network. Also, you know, tonight we're having a rally because school police are trying to get guns in schools. And that's just not the direction that we need to go. So 5 o'clock tonight at the school board building. But you can definitely follow us and we can connect folks with the right resources.
And I hope people will come to City Theater and experience Pipeline with us. It's a play that's for Pittsburgh. It's about issues happening in our city. But again, through art, you get a personal story on these big political issues. And I think that that human connection is the power of theater and is what we're trying to foster over in the South Side.
Angel Gober is the lead education justice organizer for the Education Rights Network. Reginald Douglas is the artistic producer, and he is the director of the City Theater's presentation of Pipeline, October 27th through November 18th. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
See you at the theater.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, Pittsburgh's become a center for robotics, for artificial intelligence, for machine learning. It can be exciting for some, but for others, maybe a bit fearful over a loss of human control. We'll talk with Ilan Norbosch, professor of ethics and computational technologies at CMU's Robotics Institute. And for today, that is The Confluence. Our program today was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.